right. Good day, Ann Arbor and the world. This is WCBN-FM Ann Arbor, and this is It's Hot in Here, and I'm your host, Gina Gedham.
I'm Rachel Chatterton.
And I'm Aviva Glazer.
And we have an extra hot studio today. I should also say we have Shannon Bryant and Paul Mansour in the engineering booth ready to give us the
voice of wisdom. The whole team is here.
Yes, we are here to give you a good show today. We are joined by Dr. Andrew Hoffman, whose soon-to-be-released book, Builder's Apprentice, a memoir of a builder, I want to call it just a memoir, actually, is coming out soon, I believe, end of this week or beginning of next. And we're all very excited about it. And it's a turn in the direction of the writing you've done, Andrew, and we're looking forward to getting into that soon. Well, along the similar lines of book, Paul, there have been some major environmental events that have really served to catalyze movement and corporate action around particular new ways of doing business. Certainly, chemicals have made our life wonderful in many ways, better living through chemicals, I believe was the slogan at one point. But another one of these senses events is Love Canal that Dr. Hoffman has wrote about in his own work. And essentially what happened there, as far as I know, so Love Canal was a residential neighborhood.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Outside, in Niagara Falls area. And a newspaper actually discovered that there was about 21,000 tons of toxic waste that had been buried beneath this neighborhood.
Oh. And not just a neighborhood, but a school was actually built on this toxic waste.
That's right.
Oh, my goodness. And so people began to see the effects of this and sort of really became a public outcry.
And one of the cool things about this is that it was really women that were leading the activism on this, and they really publicized what was happening and pushed the government to help them out. And it actually, I don't mean to take away from Dr. Hoffman's research, I don't know about the corporate side of things, but certainly it catalyzed the government and legislation, and it led to some of the legislation that we have. The Superfund Act was pretty much due to Love Canal.
That's right. And Jimmy Carter running for office when this was happening.
Right.
That helped a lot, too.
A lot of factors there. Well, we could have no question in saying that these events were disasters that then led to something different. But I was wondering what makes a disaster and what doesn't. And I looked it up in the dictionary. Disasters are a sudden event, such as an accident or natural catastrophe, that causes great damage or loss of life. Okay, well, what's great damage or loss of life? The example sample sentence, 159 people died in the disaster. The disaster struck within minutes of takeoff. So that seems to have put somewhat of a numerical figure on this. But I think there's been many events throughout even recent history where more than 159 people have died, and yet they haven't entered our mind as collective events that have then changed things.
Mm-hmm.
And some of your work has provided insight on this.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you could give us some of that.
Well, what I think is interesting about Love Canal is how it changed our culture.
Mm.
And people don't have to die to have an event that changes our culture. What happened at Love Canal was the product of our naivete back in the 40s. Mm. There was an open pit that George Love actually dug to connect the upper and lower Niagara rivers to create a city of the future. He went bankrupt. He left it. Hooker Chemical needed a place to dump toxic waste. They used it. It was actually a perfect place because it was clay-lined. It wasn't going to go anywhere. And that's what you did in those days. And they put it in, and then the city of Niagara Falls decided to expand, and they said, we want this property. You're going to sell it to us, or we're going to take it by eminent domain. So there's a lot of complicity in here. Hooker sold it to him for a dollar and said, don't dig here. There's bad stuff. We don't know what, although there's, you know, it's reasonable to expect that, you know, would not be healthy. The city took it over, put a cap on it, or the company put a cap on it. The city promptly punctured it by putting a school on top of it, running sewer lines through it, running a neighborhood around it. And most importantly, they put a highway at the end of it, which stopped the migration of groundwater. So it turned into a bathtub and overflowed into people's basements and moved around the neighborhood, causing all kinds of problems that Lois Gibbs called a lot of attention to, happening at a time when Jimmy Carter was running for office. And out of it, we had the Superfund Act. It came at the heels of, it was quickly followed by Valley of the Drums and Times Beach, Missouri, these other sensational hazardous waste sites. And I think what's significant about Love Canal is that prior to that, environmental issues emerged from the smoke stack down the street. They didn't come from under your house, and this was brand new for the American public, and it scared the heck out of everybody, thinking, what's underneath my ground? The interesting follow-up story to Love Canal is that they're moving people back in, that they did the best they could in cleaning up the area, but there's still background contamination, and they decided it's clean enough for people to move back in, so you buy a house with a stipulation in the deed saying you know what's here, you will not sue the government, and mark sell them at 10 to 15% below market value, and they were snatched up very quickly, and much to the outrage of Lois Gibbs. He was very, very angry about this, saying that there was never proper cleanup done.
And one thing that these events seem to, do is to shift in many ways and add to the existing sort of environmental movement a very important aspect of human health and how human health is, related to the environment around mm-hmm. us. And also perhaps that we don't know the, possible effects of, every chemical.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's when these events occur that they suddenly challenge our dominant conceptions. They've been happening for a long time. Minamata in Japan, there was a bay where they just dumped mercury and people just started having birth defects. Or the London smog from all the burning of that soft coal. There were a lot of deaths from that. But you just accepted that that's the way you had to do things. So a combination of these events that call attention to problems in new ways and technologies to deal with it, you know, that's what changes.
We like change here. Not a thought in here. All right, we're here with Andy Hoffman, professor at the Ross School of Business and the School of Natural Resources Environment at the University of Michigan, and I believe the assistant or associate director of the Herb Institute.
The associate director, yep.
Global sustainability. What a wonderful project. We're really, really, really into global sustainability. So you've written over 7 books, and this is now your 8th book coming out. And this is about your personal experiences, sort of, I think it's been described as a coming-of-age story in many ways, kind of moving against the expectations that perhaps society has for us and doing what we really feel. I'd like to actually start talking about the book by giving a quote that you present in before the first chapter, I believe. This is from Romans 12:2. Yes.
What a time for the screensaver.
I know, right? It says, do not copy the behavior and customs of this world, but be an original and different person with a fresh newness in all you think and do. Then you will be truly satisfied in what is good, acceptable, and perfect.
Well, that's a way to start this off. It isn't a religious book.
There are many lessons
right
to be learned.
Testament right there.
I just like the quote.
It's a beautiful quote.
It is. It is. It's just, you know, I see so many people conforming to the pressures from outside. And this book was a period in my life where I did something completely outrageous. Even when I look back on it, I'm shocked that I did it. And I think it's a lesson for others to do what you want to do and not feel the pressures to do what you think you're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
Even from people who think they have their best interest, your best interest in mind.
I think some of us have perhaps even faced that in our own career choices to work in nonprofit fields or even some to in the particular fields that we are studying now.
Mm-hmm.
And your book is coming out on Huron River Press in the coming days.
That's right.
But for those of us who aren't familiar with these choices that you made, what was this progression? Where did you find yourself after you graduated from college, like every...
Well, I'll give you the short.
Every good person
the
should.
The short synopsis. I mean, I went to college because I was supposed to. It was grades 13, 14, 15, and 16. I picked chemical engineering. I have no idea why. I didn't even think about what a chemical engineer did until I graduated.
Sounds very employable.
Yeah. My father was very pleased with that. Good. He always sent me the salary projections for chemical engineers. But it wasn't until I got out. I was like, holy smokes, what am I doing? What is this for? There's a wonderful line. Tim Hall at BU studies careers, and he has a great line from someone who was like 45, and she suddenly came to a realization. She said, oh, my God, my career was picked by an 18-year-old. And, you know, what was the thinking behind that? And so I got out, and I was going to clean up the environment, and so I took a job at the EPA and promptly hated it. I was not suited to be in the government. I despised it. But decided that what I was supposed to do then was be higher in government, and that will make things better. So I applied to grad school and public policy, got into Harvard and Berkeley, and froze. I just couldn't do it. There was a real block, and I had helped a friend build a deck. I got a charge out of it, answered an ad in the paper, took a job as a carpenter on Nantucket, sat down with my parents and said, I'm not going to Harvard or Berkeley, I'm going to be a carpenter in Nantucket, which was an interesting conversation. And within 2 years, I was supervising a 29,000-square-foot house in southwestern Connecticut. So just the brass tacks of the story of learning how to build houses like that is a great story. But then beyond it, you know, the identity shift I went through, the idea of pursuing a calling, that's a major underlying theme in the book.
Absolutely. And I can't wrap my head around what a 29,000-square-foot house looks
big,
like.
Very big. The architects, just as a joke, drew it up, I think, as a 30-unit condo, and it worked quite nicely. It didn't have a lot of rooms. It just had really big rooms. The living room, the great room, measured something like 25 feet by 50 feet with a 16-foot ceiling. But indoor pool, indoor gym, servants' quarters, four-car garage, 800-amp service. It was beautifully designed. It was designed in the shingle style. I was sent to Newport to take a look at the casino and other projects by McKim, Mead & White. So it was a particular style. It was very beautiful.
And we are here with Andy Hoffman talking about his new book, Builder's Apprentice, a memoir.
What?
Ooh.
Oh,
yeah,
he's ready for that.
And another quote from the book. This is from Ralph Waldo Emerson. Each man has his own vocation. His talent is his call. There is one direction in which all is open to him. So I suppose my first question now is, why write a memoir now? Most people seem to write memoirs from their deathbeds, and you certainly look very healthy.
Well, I don't think you have to wait till you're dying to write a memoir if you have a life story. That it has to be more than just the events of the story. There has to be a deeper a theme behind it. I wrote this 20 years after building those houses, and if I had just written it right after, it would just be a story about the mechanics of building a house. But I was able to think more deeply about what it meant for me in my life and what it could mean for others. I did structure it around the idea that the process that a man goes through to become a monk, the opening as a postulant, you go into the monastery and you try out the lifestyle. And then you leave and you live in the real world. It's called discernment, and decide whether you want to go back. Then you go back as a novice and then become a master. And I took that job as a carpenter on a house in Nantucket for a very powerful executive of a corporation. And it was like being a tourist. And then I went back to engineering, what I was trained to do, and still hated it. And then went back and really took on building in a serious way as a novice. And then I was the master builder, and so I think there's something there. There's something others can learn from, and I personally much prefer nonfiction to fiction. I much prefer to read stories about real people than these artificial people of popular novels of the day. I find them much more inspirational, much more challenging,
and useful in many ways.
Right.
So, what compelled you to start building houses?
I don't know.
Big question.
It was a gut. It was just in the gut. It was just, I was young enough that it didn't matter. You know, I started as a lark. I'll just do it for the summer. I mean, Nantucket's not a bad place to be for the summer. But it was just something that got me really excited, the way chemical engineering never did. And I just loved it. I just loved the feeling, and I still do. I mean, my neighbors laugh at me that my house is a project, not a home. I mean, I'm constantly working on it, and it's tremendously satisfying.
Is there something about work that you're actually physically engaged with,
mm-hmm.
whereas maybe you could physically be engaged with arranging molecules on a desktop or something like that?
Well, there's a satisfaction of seeing it change every day. There's a satisfaction of knowing that this is, you know, good work. If someone walked into one of my houses and said, this is a piece of junk, I'd look them dead in the eye and say, you don't know what you're talking about. If someone grabbed one of my books today and said, this is a piece of junk, I'd feel compelled to say, you know, why do you think that? You know, I saw a really great interview, I read an interview with Mike Rowe, you know, the guy from Dirty Jobs.
Mm.
He's a very smart, thoughtful man. And he said, you know, the people in the trades are the most self-actualized people out there, because they come in, there's a problem, they fix it, thank you very much, ma'am, and they leave. And it's out of their mind, and they're done. And, you know, in academics, it's never done.
Never done.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was going to be my question. How does this
this building that you do. You do this mostly in your free time?
Now, yeah.
What do you do all day long?
Well,
how does that kind of complement the building that you do?
Well, I mean, I love writing. And when I was a builder, I wonder what my life would be like if I'd never left building. And it could have turned out that way. I never read, and I didn't know I could write, and I love writing. I really, which is evidenced by, you know, the number of books and articles I've read. And I enjoy teaching. I enjoy influencing young people in their lives. And I think this book is a little out of the track of my academic writing, but it is teaching. I'm trying to teach. The audience for this is the young people in my classrooms who I see feeling tremendous pressure to build their resume. I see kids starting to build their resume from eighth grade now. I mean, what you're teaching somebody is that the measure of the quality of your life is measured by somebody else evaluating on a piece of paper, and that's a horrible lesson to teach. What I'm trying to say here is, you know, do what turns you on, and you need to take some time to figure out what that is, and you'll live a much more satisfied life. You may not get rich. This is not, you know, it's not necessarily the path to riches, but it'll be your life, and that's the key. You come to the end and say, I lived somebody else's life, you know, the Talking Heads song, How Did I Get Here? I mean, that's what it's all about.
You may not get rich in money.
Yeah.
There are other things to be rich in.
Well, we're going to listen to a brief excerpt from the movie Say Anything. This is one of my favorite quotes from a movie of all time. And then we'll see what advice Andy has for Lloyd Dobler when he's thinking about his future.
Spend as much time possible with Diane before she leaves. Seriously, really. I'm totally and completely serious.
No, really.
You mean our career? I don't know. I've thought about this quite a bit, sir, and I would have to say, considering what's waiting out there for me, I don't want to sell anything, buy anything, or process anything as a career. I don't want to sell anything bought or processed, or buy anything sold or processed, or process anything sold, bought, or processed, or repair anything sold, bought, or processed. You know, as a career, I don't want to do that. So, my father's in the Army. He wants me to join, but I can't look for that corporation. So, what I've been doing maybe is kickboxing, which is a new sport, but I think it's got a good future. As far as career longevity, I don't really know because, you know, you can't really tell. Training six as a fighter, you know, is no good. You know, you have to be great. But I can't really tell if I'm great until I had a couple of pro fights. But I haven't been knocked down yet. I don't know. I can't figure it out. That's so I'm just going to hang with you, dog.
Yeah. So hang out with your girlfriend and kickbox? Or?
Well, there's a curveball. Boy. You know, what he's trying to do, I guess, is articulate his ideology, his philosophy for what's going to guide his career, and I think that's important. I see students with the best of intentions come to me and say, you know, what position can I go into to have the most impact and or make the most difference? And I say, wrong question. Because I can tell you, okay, you want to make the most impact? Go be an accountant for an oil company, and then you can really change things. And if you don't like crunching numbers, you will die. You will become an alcoholic. You'll become depressed. You have to find a place that fits you, and then you will grow, and you will become the best you can be. And that's different for everybody. It could be raising a family. It could be any number of things. You know, on the area of the environment, I think students have to think carefully about what kind of environment they want to be in to realize their goals. You know, you can go into an organization like Patagonia. Everyone gets it. Your impact, you'll be surrounded by wonderful people. Your impact's going to be tiny. Or you can go to ExxonMobil. You're going to be surrounded by a lot of people that don't get it, and you're going to be fighting a good fight. You can have big impact, but it's a hard slog. You know, what kind of person are you? What environment do you thrive in? And then go there. And, you know, so Lloyd may start kickboxing. That doesn't mean he's going to be kickboxing for the rest of his life, but the key is he's choosing his life, and he's not going to let someone else choose it for him. Although I do question the idea of someone wrapping their life around someone else to give them that meaning. That sounds dangerous to me.
I completely agree with that pack as well. Yeah, you're healthier if you both have your own goals and directions, etc. And we're here with Andy Hoffman talking about his upcoming released book, Builder's Apprentice, a memoir. Holler! So I'm wondering, what makes a good home?
Hmm.
If you're building a home, what makes it solid, both structurally and for your enjoyment?
I like a house that's interesting. It's a personal question.
Exactly.
I mean, what do you like in a house? I have a joke that an interesting house is a house where you have to ask where the bathroom is. If, you know, a lot of these like mansions, you can walk in, and I know the layout when you walk in the front door. You've got that standard two-story atrium with the chandelier, the paste glass, the stairway going up, the great rooms to the right, the formal dining rooms to the left. You go straight through, and you're into the other parts of the house. You know, the houses that I built were all totally custom. The owners hired an architect. Some of them had engineers, structural engineers. The 29,000 square foot house had a steel infrastructure, 17 zones. It was a monster. It was a really massive house, and it had just the fine detail that was in it. One of my favorite books right now on houses is The Not So Big House, and that whole idea that you can build these big McMansions, these big boxes, or you can shrink them and take all that extra money and put it into the detail work and make a really beautiful, rich environment. And you know, while I was building those monster homes, I did have at one time visions of when I was leaving that company, I had visions of getting a degree in architecture and engineering and designing and building my own houses, taking that level of detail and bring it down to a level that the average homeowner could buy and afford. That to me is an interesting house, not just sheetrock squares or cubes that people live in.
Absolutely, those seem like nightmare neighborhoods. And I think we've seen that in some ways.
Mm.
Well, you've spent most of your academic career, and this fantastic memoir, which I have to say is interesting and lyrically written and ties in a lot of elements from living and what was going on in your mind, and also, as you mentioned, how it has been processed since those times were experienced. But since then, since those moments, you've entered an, I'm using quotes here, by academic sort of phase.
Yeah.
In your life. Where you've worked to build theory and to provide advice, particularly to corporations, as far as I understand it, to get engaged in environmental issues.
Mm-hmm.
So what is different between building a house and building theory that advances our knowledge of things?
I mean, both have a logic and a structure, I guess. I think that I think a better way to maybe phrase that question is, what is the theory in this memoir?
There you go.
And this represents a direction I want to start to go in, and that is the idea of helping students start to think more about their career as a calling, particularly in management. If we continue to produce MBAs whose only or primary objective is to make themselves as rich as they can, then we've got a problem. And I don't think that that's going to lead to very satisfying lives. I do see a lot of students come in with these really noble ambitions, and then it comes down for graduation, and, you know, where are you getting a job? Well, I'm getting at McKinsey for $150,000 with a $30,000 signing bonus. And it's very hard to say at that point, well, I'm going to take this job for the World Wildlife Fund for $60,000. And so the pressure for conformity.
Gosh, in my world, $60,000 sounds pretty good. It's going to be a lot less than that.
But I think that we need a transformation within business to get people to start to think about the real power that managers have in this world and the responsibility that comes with that, and to see the great power of really making the world a better place through business. I mean, let's face it, any of the solutions to the problems we face in this world, they have to come from business. That drivetrain under your hood, the buildings you live in, all the solutions, whether poverty, at all, it's going to come from business. And unless you get some people that are more internally directed, and I don't think it's that unusual an idea, I just want to give voice to it. There's a lot of people in business who see what they do as a responsibility to their employees, a responsibility to their customers. I mean, responsibility needs to be brought into the dialogue a lot more in terms of what we teach people in business schools.
And my limited understanding of more of the institutional history of how these ideas developed is that the University of Michigan was very integral in thinking about the sort of triple bottom line, the corporate and social environmental responsibility.
Yeah, sure. The Erb Institute, formerly Kemp, started in 1992. Stu Hart got it going. It was one of the first programs of its kind in the country, and a model that others are trying to copy now. This thinking on the idea of management as a calling is not just for those students, though. It's for any student. I find it puzzling that a student can graduate from business school and say, you know, maybe I'll go work for Coke, or maybe I'll go work for a hospital, or maybe I'll work for, you know, the steel company. Can people really be so broad in their interests? Is there really nothing there that says, no, I really, you know, I'm really jazzed by making cars, and I really get a buzz out of making cars, and I want to make cars. I mean, I remember, you know, I just think that, you know, is a real strong driver here, is get people to slow down and say, you know, unlike me that graduated with a chemical engineering degree and then decided what a chemical engineer does, I think a lot of people start an MBA and at the end say, what does an MBA do? Because once you start, you're running pretty fast. You don't have time to stop and contemplate, and I really want to try and help students do that.
That's fantastic. And something really about thinking that it is, that educational development is more than just learning things in a book or learning how to think, but learning how to think within yourself.
To have the judgment to make value judgments, because you'll find them creeping up on you when you least expect it. You can go into the hotel industry. You can find yourself the CEO of a major hotel chain. Guess what? There's a good chance that you're a pornographer, because a major bottom line in most hotel chains is in-room porn. Mm-hmm. Is that what you intended to do? Is that intended to be? You know, if you're not prepared to start to ask yourself questions like that, then you're going to get caught off guard. And, you know, I'm not trying to get moralistic about it, but I'm just trying to say that if you, you know, you're Lloyd Dauber, he's laying out what he wants to do, and the challenge is to hold true to that as you go through your life.
Absolutely. My own limited experience, when I was working at a nonprofit, I felt great every day, because even if I was doing a task that was fairly mundane in a particular way, when I left work at the end of the day, I knew it was for a cause that I truly believed in.
And it doesn't have to just be that. In the book, I have a discussion with a friend of mine who owns his own shoe store. And he says, look, Andy, I clean toilets, but I feel good about it because they're my toilets,
mm-hmm.
And it's my company, and I feel great satisfaction doing that, and I'm providing for my family. Whatever it is, and whatever your calling is, go for it. But figure out what that is before you allow others to channel it for you.
Tough question, but do you have some suggestions on how to find your calling?
Well, you know, it's through mentors. It's through people you bounce ideas off of. It's through taking some time out and slowing down and really analyzing less in your head, I think, and more in your gut and your heart. I mean, one difference about this book than my other work is that in my academic work, I have to lay out what I can prove, what I know.
Mm-hmm.
And this book is what I believe. And what you believe is much more important in how you get through your world than what you can prove and what you know. Contrary to what we may teach in a business school education, most leaders don't sit down, run regression analysis, and the correlation that's the strongest decides which way they want to go. It's character, it's leadership, and we need to focus more on doing that. And that's a major part of the book.
Well, I certainly recommend that we all run out and get one.
Buy many. Get a lot of them.
Get them for your family or a younger brother who's in college or whatever. But it is certainly an inspiration to read and to see about that journey. Do you have any thoughts that so it ends at this sort of moment where you're finishing up, and there's great discussions of the sort of intimate working relationships that form around your experiences,
mm-hmm.
and that was one of the most, I think, enriching parts of the book for me. But will there be a memoirs part two?
I don't know. I mean,
Nerd's Apprentice or something?
I have some friends who have read it and said, you just sort of glossed over the fact that you left construction and now you're a professor. How in the world did that happen? And I even allude to it and say that's a story for another day.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I'll write it. I don't know if it's an interesting story. But in time, if I do start to think that there's a lesson there, then maybe I will. But if I don't, I'm not just going to tell a story to puff myself up and tell you another story about the life of Andy Hoffman.
Well, that seems like a humble way to do it. I think we should end on a quote and then take it to a tune. So this is another quote that Andy had in his book. This is the legendary Henry David Thoreau. I learned this, at least by my experiment, that if one advances confidently in the direction of his dreams and endeavors to live the life which he has imagined, he will meet with a success unexpected.